This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning. Today we've a somewhat busier day than usual. We're going to celebrate Lunar New Year. And then we also have our, I almost said parish council, that's not right, that's my brother, Sangha Council meeting today. So kind of a lot on the menu. So I don't want to talk too long, but I don't want to talk too long anyway, regardless. So. This week, I was unfortunately ill for a lot of the time, so that I didn't get to sit with everybody as much as I would like. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but sometimes if you're accustomed to a certain amount of formal practice, sitting practice and so forth, when you're not doing that, the what you might call the soup gets a little thicker. And by soup, I mean the stuff that goes on with us. Our inner life. Practice has a way of kind of thinning the soup a little bit, so there isn't so much of a stew. So I noticed that this week the stew is a little denser, more stuff floating around, and there's nothing wrong with that, unless, you know, we get confused and start to think that we need some practice to fix that. Like taking some, you know, I don't know, drug or something, or some medicine to thin out the stew. And that's a tempting thought, and you see that quite a bit, you know, even among pretty experienced practitioners. It crops up pretty often at the monastery at Tassajara when people are going from, like, the winter training period, which ends in April, usually. It used to end beginning of April, now it seems to end at the end of April, and into guest season. And then once the guest season starts rolling, people start to feel like the stew is very thick. And it's kind of bothersome, you know? People want to go back to when the soup was a nice thin soup with all this stuff floating in it. But if we do have that feeling, again, it's a little bit of a flag to indicate that, well, because we're not really trusting our practice that much. If we still want to use it for something. I want to use my practice for something. To be more successful. Or a better boss. Or a better spouse. Or even, you know, to save all beings. If we think that we're going to relate to practice as a device or a gadget or something, then our practice is going to get narrow. And Suzuki Roshi pointed out very often that narrow practice tends to discourage people a lot. You probably recall that he said, well, we sort of have Hinayana practice with a Mahayana heart. And he's not exactly around for us to ask him about that, but I'm pretty sure that what he meant was our practice is, in this tradition, it's fairly specific. There's a fair amount of detail. There's certain ways that you do stuff. There's certain stuff that you don't do. And you have kind of a list of do's and don'ts. That's the, so to say, Hinayana part. And I think he used that word, Hinayana, even though it is, as we know, pejorative. So you could say kind of old style, very old style practice. And then the newer style practice, the Mahayana heart, of course, is the heart where all beings are included, and that our effort is, it's filtered through, if you like, this body-mind, but its radiance is to encompass all beings. So on the one hand, practice has a lot of kind of specifics to it, and you can learn about those if you want, and that is what sort of gives practice a shape, or a taste, or a color, or, gives it some expression and extension in the waking world. And then there's this Mahayana heart, which has no limits. Now, of course, if you talk that way, sometimes then people will assume that they have to produce this Mahayana heart somehow, and that they have to have some feeling that their Mahayana heart is encompassing all beings. And if they could just feel that, then everything would be fine. And eventually then people usually get a little bit disappointed when they realize, well, I don't seem to be able to do that. I can't make my heart encompass all beings. And and then if they do have that experience, then maybe they'll talk to their Dharma friends, and their Dharma friends will say, well, no, that's right, you're not supposed to have some feeling. It's more like, is the attitude of the heart that open? Is it that encompassing? Is it that roundly expressive? Such that the vow can extend itself into any particular corner of our life at any time, whenever the need arises or whenever the invitation is presented. And as always, you're not going to know what that looks like. And it's probably not going to fit whatever agenda you may have thought up, even without realizing that you had thought up an agenda. So that means we're kind of thrown back on this sort of Hinayana business of what to do and what not to do. And we need to warm that body of practice with this heart. And the way you do that is you let it happen. You don't make it happen. You let it happen. So when you're sitting, your actual sitting practice, you may not have, you may not have any particular sense of anything when you're sitting. This week, I've kind of had a sense of the stew being rather dense. It's like, there's too much stew here. I don't want to do this. If I sit more, the stew will thin out. It's like, well, you know what, let's avoid the tendency of narrowing practice so that I can make it do something. Let's let the Mahayana heart warm that body of practice. And sounding like poetic flights of fancy, as this Mahayana heart includes all beings and so forth, expresses something about how our being actually is. in the world. So usually this is, I know, here I am repeating myself again, but this is asking a lot of people to trust that completely. And particularly when we're sitting, to trust that completely. Because the old style, the Hinayana aspect of our practice kind of comes to the fore when we're sitting, and we look for the instructions and how we're supposed to arrange the body and so forth, and the breathing, and there's also usually a tendency to try and do something with the mind. For instance, it's rare that people don't arrive here for Zazen instruction, it's rare for someone not to mention, well, I really like my mind to calm down. So they come and they think, well, if I meditate, my mind will calm down. So that means that they're trying to use sitting or meditation practice to calm their mind. And it's usually not so easy to get people to kind of relinquish that and to tell them that, if you stop fiddling with your mind, it's deeply calm nature will express itself. That most people find that a little hard to believe. What? My mind calm? No, my mind's very busy. And the most, like, very, very, very smart people have the most trouble with that, because their minds are very, very active, and they're always doing stuff and making connections and planning things and so forth. And if you try to tell them, well, no, actually, your mind is quite calm, they'll say, no, my mind is not calm. I have a very high IQ, and my mind is very busy, and therefore I should meditate so that everything will calm down. And we're like, no, if you want to do that, try Xanax. If that's what you really think you need, do that, and then you can have an experience of calm, and then you can see if that's really what you want. And if that is, then you don't need to meditate. Just take Xanax. And then usually people realize there's a little irony when you say stuff like that. And they'll say, now, wait a minute. Are you putting me on here? And I'll say, well, yeah, actually. One of the first hurdles to leap in practice is that of realizing that you can let the process attend to itself. And that your karma of constant involvement and fiddling and doing stuff, you can let that calm down without trying to force anything onto it. And of course, this is a broad and deep stream in Buddhist practice, and there are others. There are the ones that say, you should sit down and meditate on a disk of earth, or a candle flame, and narrow your attention. This is another approach, and it has a long history that antedates Buddhism. And you can do that if you want, but probably what you're going to find is at some point that will start to feel too narrow. As a result, people who have been practicing in such traditions, for instance, I think probably we'd say the Western Vipassana tradition, which is not really like the Eastern Vipassana tradition, because it can't be. Even there, the people who are most experienced with that, you realize their practice has some this sense of this feeling of being very, very broad, like a broad river, and not so much like a narrow, cramped little focus on some particular exercise. And our sitting practice tries to, so to say, invite us to take our seat not only next to, but in this broad, deep river. Let the current flow, and notice with a benevolent heart all our tendencies to fiddle with stuff and do stuff and make things happen, and let that fall away. Thus, to sit in the deep, true nature of body-mind, which, as we said last week, is falling away. That's its nature. You can visualize the words body and mind. You can visualize them as having quotes around them. Body, mind. And then when the quotes fall away, true body and mind, the true body mind reveals itself. And the quotes, we have to keep putting there. Quotes are not there by nature. The quotes are established, among other things, through the karma of language. And when we let that impulse, which will be coming up over and over again, let it spend itself in the void and fall away, we're practicing with body and mind that fall away. I was surfing the internet the other day, and I was reading an article about how in American, mostly, Protestant Christianity, theology of, what's his name, John Calvin, or Jean Calvin, I'm afraid, rather humorless-seeming Swiss gent, from quite a while ago, has for some reason is kind of like there's an upsurge in interest in the theology of Monsieur Calvin. I'm not sure why. I don't honestly see what attracts people about it, but it was interesting to note that they've come up with this acronym. I don't know if some of you have seen that, as a kind of précis of Calvin's teaching, and it's TULIP. T-U-L-I-P. And apparently people are running around, you know, TULIP, yes, TULIP, you know, and TULIP groups and stuff. And various pastors of various congregations are preaching TULIP. You know? So TULIP, I think I have this right, stands for total depravity. Okay. In other words, you're all sinners, all of you. You know, and too bad. That's just the way it is. And don't even think about doing anything about that, because that's the way it is. And then you is something like, I forget what the you is, something like undisputed or something, election. And this is that business that, you know, how do people think these things up? But this is a clear example to me of the karma of language fouling things up. Right. So somebody decided, well, let's see. God knows everything. Therefore, God knows who already are the saved and who are the not. Right? This is what's known as like the election, being among the elect. It's already set, you know? So you just kind of got to go with that. And you might be one of those, and God already knows who you are. And if you're not, well, we're sorry. But that's the way it is, you know? So there's that. And then there's, L is limited. What do you call atonement? So you can't really atone for all your bad stuff, except for a very limited degree, right? Just a little bit, that's all. Right? So if you do bad stuff, it's, you know, it's going to stick with you. Right? And limited atonement. I is irresistible grace. Irresistible grace. Right? This is the effect of the of the divine, benevolent Holy Spirit, you know, which its functioning in the person is known as grace, and it is irresistible, right? And then the P is that something like the perseverance of the saints, which means if you are one of the good ones, you might backslide a little bit, but it's only temporary, right? Because once you're among the saved, you stay there. So this is, there are people who are sort of going about brandishing this kind of theology and preaching it to one another. And I must say, as I was reading this, I was getting the feeling like it was hard for me to see how this was going to be good for people. All this stuff about, can you imagine, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and starting to worry if you're one of the elect? I mean, what if you're not? And you know, there's only limited atonement, so it doesn't matter whether you're sorry for, you know, robbing that bank or whatever you did. I mean, it's not going to make any difference. And yes, there's grace. And if you're one of the elect, the effect of grace will simply be to buoy your heart and help carry you through the end of your life, at which point you will join the rest of the elect up in the clouds. So it was a little bit of a bummer to read that this is a rising tide in certain modern Christian circles, and that some folks, and a lot of them sort of young folks in congregations that used to be kind of small and now are kind of big, and they're all running around waving the tulip, you know. And I sort of felt like, you know, that's not really like our practice, except maybe the irresistible grace part. Now that's kind of like our practice. We are all, except that we say, everyone is elect. Everyone without exception is among the elect, and that everyone is within the ambit, within the radiance of irresistible grace. And this is the if you like, silent joy of our sitting. Our sitting practice, also our standing, walking, and lying down practice. So, if there are any Calvinists in the room, I apologize. I don't mean to be bad mouthing your faith, but I found it sort of puzzling why people would think that was attractive or even interesting, unless this business of like a total depravity really strikes a chord with you. You know, it's like, yeah, we're totally depraved, and I could see how we could think that. But I would rather focus, you know, recognize irresistible grace as an expression of this Mahayana heart. And because that is so limitless, we also have this, so to say, Hinayana practice with a number of specifics that just help us find a little place of balance and stillness in the midst of this irresistible radiance. The great vow, sometimes called Amitabha's great vow, the vow to save all beings. And that shall be the theme, the theme song of our life, of our being in this world. So I don't know. What do you think about that? We got any tulip fans in here? It's okay. We will not burn you at the stake if you wish to espouse that. Any former Calvinists in here? Oh, yes.
Well, I can see how it would make sense if you take into consideration the traditional attitudes of how do you tell election? Well, basically, mm-hmm. whether you flourish in the world, mm-hmm. you become rich merchant, and then
they're being smiled upon.
The homeless, well, they're losers, and they're obviously not elect. Mm-hmm. Well, as this country has a greater and greater economic socio gap between those two poles, mm-hmm. it seems like there might be a tendency mm-hmm. to want to justify that. Yeah,
maybe. So,
mm-hmm. But that could be an exterior factor. I like your grace and those, but I think there might be some objective socio-political factors too.
Maybe so. Of course, there are Buddhists who get into that too. It's like those in the gutter must deserve to be there, and that's a very it's kind of a, you know, low level or primitive understanding of karma, but that crops up, you know, worldwide, whether it's Calvin or Buddhism or something. People, you know, can say that, what's that little thing they say? There but for the grace of God. why. You can say that in a way that sort of puts people down. You can also say it in a way that brings you closer to them. And that difference of heart is a significant aspect of our practice. The whole Mahayana, if you like, is something about it, an attitude of the heart. Right? Not so much it's not some new revelation or special dispensation, it's just recognizing and trying to embody the truth of self and other are not two. How do we live in a way that accepts and passes on that resonance? Well, it's an attitude of heart more than anything else. And this is enshrined in our little Hinayana practice of sitting and ceremonies and all the other stuff we do. So I don't know. The idea is, you know, you give a Dharma talk in order to encourage people, but it doesn't always work that way. So, yes, back there.
A talk recently shared with me a parable that I wasn't familiar with, and I'm thinking, Jesus may have had the situation covered.
Mm-hmm.
The two men who go up to the temple,
and one.
Right.
Yeah,
the Pharisee.
Thank God I am not like other men, those slobs. And the other one is weeping.
Yes, the street priest says, Lord, have mercy on me, a sinner.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, well, if you want to take Mahayana, the only point of the story is that both men went up to the devil.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe the one who thinks he's like not like other people will get slapped upside the head by something slightly miraculous, and we'll realize that actually, oh, we're all in that boat, and we can all row together. Or we can try and consign some people to steerage and leave them there. And that makes a big difference. Yes?
Thank you, Mio, for sharing with us your feelings about not being able to sit as much as you'd like this week. Mm-hmm. I can appreciate that very much. I'd like to throw out a statement about formal zazen, and we can try it on for size and see how this works. Perhaps formal zazen is an opportunity to take some time to practice in this formal way, and during that time, we can observe the activity of mind. We can observe, especially for me, what I'm working with now, what I'm observing a lot of, is preferences as they come up. Liking this, not liking that. How do I carry that through the day? Mm-hmm. What is the result of either joining in or disdaining from preferences in my daily life? Does it cause a lot of pain
mm-hmm.
being that way? So in formal zazen practice, I can see these things come up. And I take to heart initial instruction I got in zazen years ago, which is that as thought arises, we can observe it, set it aside, and return to the breath.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a distinctive activity,
mm-hmm.
returning to the breath,
mm-hmm.
which I tend to think is a non-preferential activity. You know, we do
okay.
It's a natural activity, it just simply occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the point, is then to, in this formal zazen practice, we can see the difference. We can observe the difference between an activity of mind, which is in this way manifesting itself as preference, and returning to something that is without preference,
mm-hmm.
and that enables us to see the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can then carry that observation into the walking, sitting, and lying down
mm-hmm.
activities of daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, does that qualify as an activity in zazen that maybe at some point isn't even necessary
mm-hmm.
to carry on?
Mm-hmm. Well, this week I was able to notice again that I have a preference for doing zazen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, well, it's lucky that grace is irresistible because here I am. I've actually adopted a way of life that expresses a preference for for doing zazen, mm-hmm. for living this way and not that way. Mm-hmm. So this brings us back to the whole distinction between states of mind with outflows and states of mind without outflows. Mm-hmm. And states of mind, as we've said many times, that are rooted in wrong view, namely that self and other is a literal, irreducible truth, those have outflows. And yet, even with that frame of mind, if I'm doing wholesome practices, like following my breath or, you know, refraining from violence or anger or something like that, those states of mind may have outflows, but those are good outflows. Those are tending in the direction of liberation eventually. Mm-hmm. So is it possible to follow the breathing in a way that doesn't lean either towards annihilation or eternalism? In other words, can it be so so straightforward and so unfreighted with, you know, emotional whatnot, that it becomes as simple as breathing itself, expressive of this being as breathing is? Can I simply make this turning of attention to be unfreighted with a whole lot of preference? Mm-hmm. And actually, yeah, you can. Mm-hmm. The more you carry on this way, the less the baggage of preference seems to make itself felt in one's practice. Mm-hmm. So if we ask the question, can practice that is actually an expression of preference, can that actually be beneficial? Yeah, it can. It can. Mm-hmm. But it's also not even that's not necessary, which may be what you were getting at.
Yes.
Many years ago, I was told, you know, when I thought, well, you have to count the breath, right? And my teacher at the time said, well, you can just follow your breathing. Mm-hmm. And the thing about just following our breathing is, particularly at first, people sometimes feel like, well, I'm not doing enough. I better count my breathing too, because this following my breathing, well, nothing happens, you know, and I'm supposed to emerge from meditation a better person. But eventually, the more we study the teaching, the more this Mahayana heart comes up over and over again as the grounding of our attitude. And we have someone like Dogen who's constantly telling us, your practice is extremely broad. Don't try to rope it in, you know, by anything. And that's kind of a challenge. But as time goes on, less and less so, it starts to feel more and more natural to practice that way. And I think that's probably a good thing, quote unquote.
Thank you. That's a really supportive thing to say. Thank you.
Objections? Yes. Yes, please.
It has been said, right, that it's not like an image reflected in a mirror, the moon reflected on the water.
Uh-huh. The moon reflected in the water.
When one side is illuminated, the other side is
it's dark. Yes, so they say.
Is that a statement of the human condition?
Yes, but I don't think by dark it means like, ooh, bad.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. A dark just simply means this is where conscious, you know, what does it say in the Jhumir Samadhi we chanted this morning? It's not reached by feelings or consciousness. That's dark. All right? However, you can turn feelings and consciousness in any direction you like. That's light. Right? But simultaneously, no. When one's a light, the other's dark. Right? That's just how it is. And that works perfectly well for us. And it's important to keep that in mind and not to think that, well, I'm trying to do is get everything dark, right, and kind of go to live there. It's like, no, that's not how it works. The mind is bright, and also, as the old sayings have it, in the dead of night, the moon shines on thatched cottages. This is a little poem about the dark. Right? Even in the dead of night, there's a moon somewhere. And you can profoundly trust that. So all the Buddhas and ancestors tell us. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. right in light, what does he say? There's darkness. Right in darkness, there's light. This is very Chinese, but also very Buddhist in its way. Speaking of Chinese, yes, oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to, I'm a little caught up with the Huguenots and the Calvinists. And,
yeah.
So I got a Huguenot ancestor.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm. And I feel sorry for the Huguenots, you know, back then. I don't think that's what they meant, mm-hmm. you know, the tulip.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another example of how something could be taken and used like medicine as ingredients and to stir the pot, T-U-L-P.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows us just a lack of empathy and a huge amount of disrespect for a group of people who was trying their best at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
You know, who knows what they meant?
Mm-hmm.
They were slaughtered.
Most
of them were slaughtered.
Yeah.
Who know what they, you know, what they meant?
Yeah.
You know, here we are trying. You get these people trying to come up with something for this righteousness, but this is a huge lack of disrespect
respect,
and empathy
yeah.
for you know, these group of people that tried their best at the time.
Yeah, I don't think the Mahayana heart was behind the St. Bartholomew's Eve massacre. Something tells me, you know,
uh-huh.
probably not. And. You know, there was some creepy stuff going on in the Roman Church. There still is. And for some people to stand up and say, that's creepy, was very brave. And was perhaps, okay, there's the irresistible grace trying to, you know, give voice to itself and say, this way that they're doing stuff, that's not quite right. And of course, then they get slammed for it. Now, well, now they're chanting tulip. So, you know, I wish them the best, and I hope that irresistible grace, you know, will touch their lives in a way that they can appreciate, and will blunt the tendency to try and declare who are the elect and who are not. Because that's an inevitable result of having this elect, non-elect stuff. And of course, you can get that in Zen, too. You know, it's like, here's the awakened ones over here. They're pretty cool. You guys, you know, you're not working hard enough. You know, try harder, try harder. And we'll hit you and make you try harder. You know, it's like, crops up there, too. So I just assume do without that. Oh, yes.
I've been listening to a lot of Joseph Campbell. Recently.
Yes, mm-hmm. Smart guy.
Mostly because that was all that was on my iPod.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I've seen that. I forget which of the tulip letters had atonement in it. Was it
limited atonement? Limited. The L. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he talks about atonement and try to think of it as at one ment.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh. Right.
Which is like the Mahayana heart.
Mm-hmm.
Thing,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Rather than beating oneself up, you know. And, yeah. Well, that's our human situation. So, one thing we can do is celebrate. So we can celebrate Chinese New Year now. And, thanks to Keido-san and Tendo-san, we have things to burn and some New Year's food to eat. And so I hope you'll all stay. And just a couple of quick things. Next week we have a guest speaker, Reverend Lien Shutt from San Francisco Zen Center. We'll come and give a talk. And then also one thing that we're thinking about doing is having a study period, maybe 6-week study period with a Shuso, and David would be our Shuso, our head monk. And what we're trying to do is like get the word out a little bit and see if any energy comes back. Because if people can't participate in that, then we don't want to just have like a just for show kind of a study period. We want to wait till there's some people can do stuff. And that would mean people being able to, okay, I'll definitely be at these periods of Zazen, and I'll come to the tea each week and come to Dharma talk and so forth. And so we're going to try and see what people have time or energy for and see if we can do this. So this is just an announcement to get the word out. You all can talk it up. and amongst yourselves and each other, and tell your Dharma friends, and we'll see kind of what comes back. Okay, yes?
Can you, or is there some way to see some kind of guidelines for this so that we know what it is that we're responding to? When you say, talk about it yourselves,
yeah.
Who's heading this up?
Who's heading this up?
Yes. Moi. Is there anybody? Who's you.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That's nice.
Right, and so you know, there's our weekly Zazen schedule. Uh-huh. So the idea would be, okay, can some people say, okay, I'll definitely be this, and this period?
Mm-hmm.
Can some people do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then we will probably try to have a tea each week.
Mm-hmm.
And can people do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then we might have we might start off with a half a day sitting or something, and then we might end with a weekend sitting, or Saturday,
mm-hmm.
Sunday. Can people do that?
Mm-hmm.
These are all the sorts of things that people can or cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And if nobody can do any of it, then maybe we'll wait a while.
Mm-hmm.
But if people can do it, then maybe we'll try it, see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't had a practice period at Isanji, I think, since 1996.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
How will word be circulated? How will
I'll send out another email, and there'll be something in the newsletter about it,
mm-hmm.
and people will have an opportunity to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, we'll cook up a little calendar thing, and people can say, "Yeah, I can do that," or "I can do some of that," or
mm-hmm.
"I don't want to do that," or whatever. We'll figure something out. Okay, well, thank you all very much.